Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Psychosocial Distancing Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Daniel Chadbourne. With me, as always, is Thomas Brooks.
Oh, hello.
So we were having a very brief discussion before this that we are only reaching a third of our potential audience.
It's quite tragic, really.
If we want to make this a quasi-teaching podcast, I mean, I think we're trying to be a full teaching podcast, but...
But we're, you know, alienating two-thirds of the people who could be listening to this podcast.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a podcast only in audio can only assist auditory learners.
Yep. So we have to post the video now on YouTube so you can see me in my pajamas.
Yeah.
And I guess we also have to like go to everybody's houses and like, I don't know. How do you do the kinetic learning?
Well, so it's reading and writing. And so they have to have a transcript.
Oh, we have to transcribe it.
We have to transcribe our podcast.
And then ask them to write down what they hear as they're listening.
Yes. And then they have to write their own transcript.
Ah, so we have to transcribe and they have to transcribe.
Which I guess is, it might be easy because whenever I listen and I'm doing editing, I'm listening at like 1.5 times speed. And so then when I go back to listening to us normally, I'm like, why are we talking so slow?
That's like, I never hear that when I'm lecturing. It's always slow down, slow down, slow down. I don't understand what's happening.
Yeah. And then I'm listening back to it. I'm like, wow, we are taking forever to get to this point. And I guess the point that we're trying to get to is that, we're going to talk about learning styles and I guess pseudopsychology typologies.
Ooh, pseudopsychology typologies. I think you found your title.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like most typologies, I think we would argue, but then, you know, we're like social psychologists, so typologies are all garbage as far as we're concerned.
And stage theories.
Because everything's a lot, everything's pretty like complex and no one's quite got the age right. And there's always exceptions to the rules with ages and there's all these little bitty differences or like they're so vast where like, I love Erikson stages because they're just, it's like,
monstrous.
here's like six stages that get you to age 20. And then like for the rest of your life, there's like three.
Four.
Yeah. Yeah.
The person who did it right, though, was Freud. Because it all happens in your unconscious. So you can argue that you shouldn't be aware of the stages that you're going through.
Yeah. And sure.
I mean, it makes it not falsifiable, but it's also not falsifiable like everybody else did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so for anyone listening, if you haven't gotten what we've been saying at the beginning, is that we think learning style, well, we don't even think learning styles are bunk. We know learning styles are bunk. We don't subscribe to styles of learning, quote unquote theory. I'm going to call it the learning styles hypothesis, because a theory would have more theoretical backing to support it.
The learning styles quandary.
Quandary. Yeah, you know, they're talked about in as sort of these theories of learning style. And we'll also talk about some other stuff. So learning styles is kind of a big thing that I think we want to gripe about in this episode, but we'll talk about some other typologies. You've got some stuff on stages of grief.
I do have stages of grief today, which is grievous.
Are you going to go through them as we go through the podcast?
We'll start with like the first one. I don't even remember what the first stage of grief is.
Is it denial?
It's denial. No, I won't be going through any stages of grief this evening.
Because you're not going to deny the fact that like there's no conflict on your feelings about the stages of grief.
Nope, there's no conflict.
Absolutely not.
Learning styles and stages of grief don't even exist. What are you talking about?
Right. Right. No, but we won't be going through all of them because I don't think we'll get to acceptance at the end of these.
No, nor will I be bargaining with them.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no bargaining. We do not negotiate with pseudo-typologies or pseudo-psychologies.
So I guess before we like dive into the weeds and explain how to like, you know, determine if a psychological like concept is pseudoscience, kind of like how we got here and how this differs from like maybe our conversation on hypnosis and like phrenology. Because I think there is quite a big difference in terms of like we're moving, like I will give like learning styles and stages of grief a little bit of credit. They were a little further along in psychology. They had more tools at their disposal. They weren't committing like, you know, Freudian unconscious sins. They weren't like looking at bones. So like these are a bit more sophisticated creatures than phrenology or the unconscious or hypnosis, for example. So I think they're, at least for me, like, they may irk me, but I don't quite think they're as like mystical as the pseudoscience we've talked about.
Yeah, like, I mean, previously. they're grounded in the research, or at least from the perspective of the research that they're done in.
Mm-hmm.
They make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're not taking into account are like the other possibilities. So I would argue that learning styles becomes an identity for the learner.
Mm-hmm.
And if you identify as a visual learner, that changes your efficacy, that changes your how comfortable you feel with visual versus auditory material. And if you feel that you're not going to learn really well, you get really nervous around stuff that it's not in your comfort zone, that's going to inhibit aspects of the learning process.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is something there where I think if you really prime people to think about themselves as a visual learner, it may have some effect in like a classroom.
Right. And
though the research also shows that even when you prime them to think that way, there's not really that much difference.
And I will say too, like, developing literacies around like reading and writing and understanding what you're watching and understanding what you're listening to, like those take time to develop.
Yeah.
And you have to work at it. Like, I don't really expect, like, I expect some basic writing, reading, and visual literacies from like freshman undergraduates, but like they've never really been lectured at before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I expect them to be pretty bad at like finding the important stuff in a lecture. And so like giving them time and space to develop that literacy. And, you know, that's why I don't give them my slides. Like, the slides exist. You do not have them. You have to take the notes. So that way you work on building that skill set, because otherwise you take a learning styles quiz online and it's like, oh, you're a reading, writing, visual learner. Don't bother with auditory stuff. And it's like, well, they've never been trained to like carefully listen, unless they're like families are churchgoers and they like hear sermons.
Yeah. And you know, I started deep diving because we talked earlier this week or last week about what we were gonna do, and you know, kind of tasked me with finding some recent stuff on it, and so I set my Google Scholar to like 2019. I didn't want to go too far ahead. I was like, let's see what's like the last 5 years, and there's a lot. There's really? A lot that's like, hey, learning styles and how we can look at learning styles in this context and how learning styles can benefit. Since 2015, from this article here, what is this from? 2022 maybe. Since 2015, there have been dozens. I think it was like 115 that they had counted pro learning styles articles in like major publications, and it's not going away.
Mm-hmm.
They can't kill it.
They can't kill it.
I said this before. There's this great quote in this article, and the article is Clements, I think 2022, update the dots before connecting them, learning styles in the 21st century. Good title. But it's a response to Justin Brunner's 2020 call for connecting the dots of student underpreparedness. And it's like, great, let's connect the dots of student underpreparedness. But those dots can't be learning styles, mm-hmm. because learning styles literature is a hot mess. And was looking at that. And so they quote Hall, 2016, who's a prominent researcher on learning styles, and particularly like debunking myths about learning styles, and said that she related her experience to watching a scary movie where the monster keeps coming back regardless of what's thrown at it. She suggested in the case of learning styles, no matter what we've hit it with, the thing won't die. I'll continue. Other writers have compared learning styles to ugly sweaters, where one gets a little enjoyment for a brief period wearing them, but realizes that they're a gimmick and would seem out of place in everyday use. And that's Barclay 2017. But despite this, the discussion is still ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they did, because where are, so like learning styles is kind of like very few things that we talk about on this podcast are like in the realm of stuff we've read and been tested over in our like PhD program, like a good number of stuff, but usually it's from us writing articles or teaching classes or stuff. Like this is like our trained area,
right?
And how many articles did we read that like experimentally controlled for like learning outcomes based on like matching modality to a learning style, and like none of it came to fruition? Like if as soon as you sort the students and like give them their preferred like material, they're still learning at the same rate as like students who have like the opposite mode given to them.
And that like goes back to like the 90s.
Yeah.
Like this isn't new in the educational psychology field. Like educational psych is like, again, every now and then they have, you know, a bunch of educational psychologists have to kind of come out of the woodwork and be like, we thought we went over this.
Mm-hmm.
Learning styles don't hold up. Here, we'll do another study. Look, it still doesn't work. All right, we're leaving. We're good, right? No more learning styles. And then they leave and everyone's like, so auditory learners, right? Like
the hybrid emerges.
Right. Yeah, and it's really funny because like this research too, like in the pro learning styles literature, it keeps saying in that literature over and over again that like there's support for it. Except that like there's this larger growing body of research that says there isn't. So they're citing these like select few mm-hmm. articles that do kind of quasi support. But part of that support is also coming from citing articles that are talking about how like things like experiential learning and like styles around like different ways in which people learn through experience and things like that. Well, they're saying, oh, learning styles. So it's the same thing that I'm doing research on. And thus I'll cite their work, or I'll talk about how learning styles research has efficacy. Except that the articles aren't supporting what they're making claims on. Or mm-hmm. it's just a kind of a bunch of articles kind of secularly citing each other on how they all support learning styles.
Right. Right. No, it reminds me like I did not know that they were taking experiential learning and like trying to like do a little song and dance about it being a learning style, because that's gross. I knew about the self-citations, like that they continuously, like it's the same like three labs that are all citing each other over and over and over again and creating this body of work that like is cyclical. It reminds me, we'll maybe pick a fight about this later. It reminds me of the, what is it, the Anders research on, what is it, expertise.
Yeah.
You dig far enough back in those citations, there is no data floor.
Right. You can't find it.
There is no, like, everything that gets cited are all literature reviews of himself.
Yeah.
And still, there's no like floor to the data that exists where it's like, hey, we found this phenomena in our participants that these number of hours are important. It just, you go this citation to that article doesn't have data. Okay, well, they cited this, so let's go to that article. That article doesn't have data. Just constantly all the way back to the 90s, no data.
Yeah, this article came out of this this Justin Brenner 2020 article that said, like, we need to look at learning styles as like a way to help students, and talks about how I'll quote them. A significant area of contention with learning styles is evaluated in employing the theories. Dimbo and Howard in 2007 suggested that faulty research laid the foundations for learning styles theory. They argued that the validity, the reliability, and the application are all questionable in the early research and the majority of these early learning style studies. And this goes back to everything from Dunn and Dunn's learning style models on categories such as like environmental, emotional support, sociological composition, Kolb's 1984 experiential learning styles labels, learning styles questionnaires, the VAC method, which is the visual auditory, it's now VARC. It's visual auditory reading and like kinesthetic. But like they're flawed. Like the start of that research was flawed in reliability, validity, and application. It's just that they got cited and they continue to get cited. And when we step in as quantitative experimental psychology, educational psychologists, we don't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still citing all this old stuff. Dimbo and Howard 2007, Pashler et al. 2009, Carr 2017 found essentially sufficient evidence in the literature that led us to believe that they're lacking in support. Evidence that they're flawed, not evidence of the learning styles.
Mm-hmm.
That they don't really explain the underlying mechanisms and the measures of learning. They just tap into like efficacy and identity as that type of learner. And again, if you got a teacher who's just like hitting you over the head with like, oh, you're a visual learner, you're gonna believe it.
We're
talking about kids, you know, high school students, elementary school students being kind of forced into this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it works on like elementary school girls when they're told that boys are better at math, and then their efficacy plummets. Like, of course it would happen with learning styles.
And not just their efficacy plummets, but the teachers grade them differently.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new study in Israel that replicated that with sixth grade male and female students and found that they're graded differently because the teachers think that the boys are better, and so they give them a little more slack in the grading.
Mm-hmm.
And then that causes the outcomes. But if you have a blind reviewer, it's the same. And so, again, there's these perceptions of the people who are doing the teaching, and then mm-hmm. the people who are like doing the research side of the education, but not the cognitive research side or the psychological aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. It kind of exists in just this amorphous vacuum of gross.
Yes.
And it's honestly like that quote about it not dying makes sense, because there are tons of people who get paid by like state and local governments and corporations to come do trainings about learning styles. Still to this day, they're still running around giving it to elementary school teachers. I saw this Forbes article in my search today that was like, you're an employer, how do you get your workers to be more productive? You need to communicate with their learning style. And I'm like, what?
No.
Please don't do that. And like, I feel bad because, and this is kind of the like really pernicious part of this too. Like when you talk about the teacher beating the kid over the head, like that teacher thinks they're doing the kid right. Like the people who apply this stuff, like they're true believers, because they're not like trained in any way to like understand that they're being sold a gimmick.
Well, I'll read this, because even those people who are like pushing it understand that it is more complex than it is, and they're using the kind of similar like ad hoc hypothesis approach of like, well, but what if it doesn't work with this kid? So an additional problem with learning styles theories is that the impracticality of distinguishing individual attributes. Advocates of learning styles and similar systems, such as Gardner's multiple intelligences, or even the universal design for learning, have argued that people are not fixed in a learning style, and that an individual may encompass more than one learning style at a time, even through the process of creating and employing distinct categories. And that an individual may encompass more than one style at a time, even though the process of creating and employing distinct categories implies a certain amount of fixation.
Yeah, no, it has, like, if you're going to use categories, you have to commit.
Yeah.
You have to, like, you can't do this, like, and this is the problem with the grief cycle we'll get to.
I hit record immediately so we could talk about how big education learning style is trying to take us down.
Yeah, no, that was crazy. I was in the middle of an excellent point. So now we've officially made enemies with Big Ag and now Big Education. Cool.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about like hypnosis all day and like nothing happens. We want to complain about learning styles.
We get one glitch and then the internet goes down.
Right. So
what was it? The other day I was having my health coach meeting on Zoom. And then all of my power just went out. Broad daylight, no wind, no rain, no snow. So my coach calls me and she's like, what happened? I was like, well, my internet went down. And I'm not entirely sure why. And she lives down in Albuquerque. And she was like, well, you do live in northern New Mexico. And I was like, yep, that's what happened. I live here.
So we were talking about the whole concept of learning styles being tied to the idea that there is a certain amount of fixation. However, yes. Supporters of learning styles will even be like, but like you could flow through them and it's not like entirely stable. We're starting to get into like state and trait personality theories. So it's like, well, we have our trait learning styles and our state learning.
And that's how you know that they've dug themselves into a hole. Right. Like if this was just like someone in their lab doing research on this and they're like, oh, hey, I think I found this cool thing. Let's try it. And then like after a couple times it doesn't work, then you drop the hypothesis.
Right.
Or you come up with another explanation, but instead they do this nonsense that the Kubler-Ross griefs stages do and the state trait theorists do, and who else does this? There's several other people that do this like post hoc nonsense where they're like, here is this like universal theory that we've developed that's stable, Myers-Briggs stable and doesn't change and blah blah blah, and then when like the soon as they get a little bit of criticism they can't back out of it because they're making too much money on it, and so they do this like ad hoc nonsense of like, oh well, maybe like the categories exist, but people move through categories. Dumb.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a quote from one promoter of learning styles, because like I think calling them promoters
promoters is on point.
Apt. Yeah. Quote, the number of attributes that distinguish one type of learner from another is uncountably large.
Oh, wow.
Encompassing most of them in a single theory would be virtually impossible. And even if it could be done, the model would be too cumbersome to be of any practical use. What? If you can't explain something in a succinct theory or series of hypotheses, there's probably a simpler explanation.
Yes. Like, I just, you know, we just like knocked a little bit on personality theory, but I will give them this. Their big five is tight. Like,
which is,
that is excellent, which is, work.
Which is why when they're like, look, like the big five holds up, it keeps holding up consistently. That's why we're saying they're state and trade, because there are environmental circumstances, there are social situations in which you can see a typically introverted person act more extroverted. Typically, standardly, they're higher on the introversion side of that scale. But put them around a bunch of close friends who they're comfortable with, they're a little more extroverted.
Mm-hmm.
Or how we can manipulate neuroticism through social comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
or
yes.
How it changes over time. So, like,
right,
you become less agreeable with age, but like, you become more conscientious, like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Neuroticism evens out over time too. So
also
like
fluctuates if you're diagnosed with anything.
Yeah. I guess we should have said that with the person who asked the question about whether or not there were any positive traits about neuroticism a couple episodes back. Don't worry about it. It should stabilize over time.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
If not, find a therapist.
So like, I'll accept big five, because at least when they make their exceptions and account for differences and environmental shifts and aging and all that stuff, the model still holds up. Learning styles, nope, doesn't hold up. They nope. Blame their participants.
Nope. Yeah. So I'm going to put a link to this article because it's good. A good overview of the literature. I found two others that kind of deal with the same. One is on nursing students, and it's the relationship between critical thinking skills and learning styles and academic achievement of nursing students. And this one actually talks a little more about like how it's like critical thinking, but again, like they're not talking about like visual, you know, how we use. Oh no, they're actually, I'm looking here now that I'm like delving a little deeper, because like they do talk about some of like the controversies with it, and it does seem that they found some statistical significance in their 139 sophomore to senior nursing students.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Oh, but you see, they're not looking at the visual auditory. They're looking at Kolb's learning styles and whether or not you're accommodating or converging or diverging or assimilating.
Whatever.
Right. Which, sure. You know, if you define accommodating as like you come to class and you take your notes and you engage, and I'm probably misrepresenting whatever the research says on accommodating learning styles, but like it sounds like the more positive when you look at the other, like convergent, divergent, and assimilator. I'm like, yeah, accommodating might be the best just based on linguistic use or terminology.
It looks like here, accommodator is concrete. You learn through concrete experience and active experimentation. So strong and hands-on practical doing.
Which for a nurse sounds like that would be great.
Right, yeah. I'm not going to like... And that's kind of the thing. Like, and this is where my heart goes out to like the elementary school teachers and like... Yeah. The poor workers at these like Fortune 500 companies that have to put up with this shit is that like there is a tiny little thing of usefulness here that you can use, and it's to pair the thing you want somebody to learn with the appropriate mode, and then to use all of the modes as much as you possibly can with the same concept, not because like you're hoping like individual students will pick up when you hit a certain mode, but because all those modes reinforce the learning that you did.
Yeah, the more ways you learn something, the more paths you learn to get to the same end result, the more reinforced that end result is, because it's ingrained in six different methods as opposed to one.
Right.
Don't just watch it, listen to it, write it. Don't fixate on one. All of them are beneficial. It's like listening to a lecture and then writing those notes down and then rewriting or typing your notes onto your computer as a backup. And also like watching,
reading the textbook.
Right. Yeah. Like going through all these different ways, like constant repetition of the material is going to ingrain that material better than just being like, I'm an auditory learner. I can't write it down. I can only listen to it. You're limiting yourself. You're going to do worse.
The only time that maybe you don't take into account a certain mode is if you have a disability with that sense.
Right.
Like if you're blind, I don't expect you to be a visual learner.
Yeah. The main problem with this is that you either have teachers who put kids into, you put them into boxes.
Tribes. Oh, boxes.
Well, tribes too. But you put them in, they're putting kids into boxes and getting them to believe that about themselves.
And then
just like that teacher who says that, like, no, boys are better at math, girls can't do math, or girls are better at English. They can't engage in like social interaction or write as well as boys can, or boys can't do as well as they can. You're creating the deficiencies in the students by doing that. And they're going to take that to heart in future classes. Much like I'm very against the employer who goes, well, we're only going to hire visual learners here or auditory learners here. Because you know, like someone out there is doing that. They've got like an entry exam or a test that you take. And if you score a certain quirky typology on it, we're going to be talking about so many quirky typologies as we kind of move forward in the season. But if your quote unquote horoscope is visual learner, then you're just not a good fit for this company.
You're not going to work at the call center.
Right. Because but unfortunately it's worse than that. It's not at like the call center. It's at like wherever,
McDonald's.
You know, what's it like the multi-billion dollar company.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Like you can't get a job at Walmart or Amazon unless you're, you know, taking these like tests to get in, and they exist. I've taken them.
I have failed every single test I've ever taken for any sort of customer service job. I like Walmart won't hire me.
So when I worked at Blockbuster, I got a promotion, and in order to be an assistant manager, I had to like fill out like the application form for it, and then we're gonna hire me. I think I took that test 4 times before I passed it. And it was just like, it's all like basic questions. But apparently what I've learned, and this is from people who like were on the backside of like the hiring process at some of these companies. I remember talking to someone in HR at like Best Buy. This was like decades ago. But like, you can do too well on those tests.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do too well, it flags you and cans your application.
Yeah, we talk about this in personality, but like all of the tests that they like, we could probably do an episode just on like employer like personality tests and the pseudoscience, because it does not tack on to reality,
right?
Like at all. It's kind of like our discussion 2 years ago about Myers-Briggs. Like it doesn't hold up in like the real world. And so you get this like hyper like surveillance-y confessional thing going on where you're like sharing your personality with this employer to like beg for work. Mm-hmm. And it's terribly disgusting.
Yeah. Except in the cases where they check your IQ, and if it's too high, thanks to the court decision, they won't let you become a police officer.
Mm-hmm. I think that episode was the only one I ever engaged in self-censorship in.
Yeah, we did censor some stuff in there. So on that note, we're going to move on and talk about... But yeah, it's just, it's one of the, it won't die. It is, mm-hmm. It is a monster that no matter what you hit it with, no matter what evidence you throw out there, the people who are promoting it, the people who are pushing, and are making money off of it are doing so on faulty premises. Mm-hmm. And this is a case where, like, as we move on with this season, we're going to talk about some real out there pseudoscience where, yes, there's some money being made, but there are some like true believers who are pushing it, and they're not making nearly as much money as these people are.
Mm-hmm.
Because this kind of is tied a little bit, like what we've tried to add is that little grain of truth that there are ways in which you can change the way in which you teach material, and mm-hmm. that can benefit students. It's not one thing or the other. It's typically multiple modalities. It's the, you know, it's the same issue I'd have with a teacher who tells my kid that he can't count with his fingers.
I'm supposed to. That's why we have them.
Right. Because again, like you're learning it visually because you're watching your teacher do it. You're learning the kind of, you're hearing the instructions. You've got the tactile response of your fingers. You're writing it down. All of those little things combined help.
Didn't Dr. Liu even have an article for us that, yes, like your digits are like connected to like the senses, like that part, yes, of your brain? So when you count on your fingers, it's like highly related to, and it's actually really good to like get that cognition out of your head and into your hands.
Yeah, no. And it's why, like, I've seen like, and I don't know when it happened, but I was nearly ready to go on a warpath. Like, my son will be like working on math and he'll put his hands under the table to count. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, he's like, I'm like, oh, that's fine. But like, you don't have to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that his teachers now like are fine with it. But at some point someone told him not to, and he, yep, gets nervous about it. And that upsets me.
Yep.
Because it's wrong. I have not yet had the opportunity to walk into a school and go, no, actually, I'm an educational psychologist. But it is in my back pocket. And one of these days, I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to be that parent.
You should, because they should be counting on their fingers.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Any, you know, and if they got to count to 20 and they got to use their toes, let them use their toes. That's fine.
Yeah.
So yeah, learning styles, gracious. it's bunk. It's garbage.
It's very, I think this might be one of the more pernicious things we're going to talk about this season out of everything. Like even like the bleach drinkers, because like, yep, learning styles affect and harm learning for so many more people than bleach drinker. Like the body count on learning styles is so much, not the body count, like they're not dying from learning styles, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, because at some point, like, not everyone's gonna buy in to drinking bleach,
right?
But this is something that is wrapped in aspects of education and is tied to lobbyists and is tied to people who have so much money to gain by perpetuating this nonsense,
mm-hmm,
that it keeps being pushed. To add one last thing to another nail in its coffin, there's this great article. It's Nance Keevil, Shaw, and Gelman, 2019. Maybe they're born with it, or maybe it's experience, toward a deeper understanding of the learning style myth. And what they did is they looked at teachers' belief in learning styles of their students and found that one of the core, because they were looking at the difference between the teachers who believed it was essentialist, like serious problems with psychological essentialism, or if they were like more flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost had everything to do with the age of the students.
Hmm.
So older students were less likely to be attributed to essentialist beliefs because that student likely had more experience to maybe help them understand why they learned. Whereas for teachers of younger students, those teachers would hold more essentialist beliefs. And I wonder if this is like confounded in a lot of where these like theories, quote unquote, are being peddled.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're going to get a lot more traction in the classroom, but they're grounded. If you're saying that you're fixed in your learning style, that it has nothing to do with who you are, it's your genes, it's your genetics, it's your upbringing. Like we're going right back to eugenics. We're going right back to like pure essentialism, biological essentialism, or in this case, psychological essentialism, which is, it's bunk.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I find that weird a little bit because like we're still like you think of the education system as still being kind of Skinnerian.
Yeah.
Like with the behaviorist stuff. And like the behaviorists would not have put up with this learning style nonsense.
Absolutely not. But
like
you know, I mean, I think of like one of the reasons why people are into a lot of these pseudosciences is that the amount of time it takes to read the research and to delve into it and to find the stuff on your own, unless you're learning it in a classroom. But for a lot of teachers who have been a part of that system, they're getting the little class that's run by the administration of the school. And it's got one of these like speakers that are being paid way too much money to come in and talk about these new concepts. And then it sounds good to the administrator. It sounds good to the school board. It sounds good to the superintendent. Because
doesn't require them to spend any more money.
Yeah, they just, it just, the teachers have to do the work. The teachers are the ones who have to accommodate the students' learning styles. The teacher, like, it just, it puts more work on the teachers. Like, you don't, then you can say, and it also makes it easier when students don't do well. It makes it easier to deal with the cognitive dissonance of you're failing your students. Well, no, I'm not. It's them.
Mm-hmm.
If they only had the better learning style. It reminds me of, for my dissertation, I did the locus of control research, and I went and found these great articles that Tajfel had written about how garbage locus of control research was because it was all like not accounting for the social situation. Because there were a bunch of people in New York school systems in like the 50s and 60s that were being like, minority students just have an external locus of control. They don't take personal responsibility and they blame it on everyone else. And so they don't learn anything. It's innate. It's ingrained in them. And Tajfel was like, this is the biggest little horse crap I've heard. No, the minority students have an external locus of control because the system is literally keeping them down.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s and 60s
and
the 70s and the 80s, like the system and the laws are out to get them. And so why would you feel that you were in control if the entire social system is not working, is completely antithetical to your favor? And that's how this feels to me. This feels like, this is my rant for the episode. This feels to me like that. It's like you've got some administrators who just, or people, like, I mean, it probably even makes the teachers feel better that like, it's not like I've really tried to help this kid, but like they just don't have the appropriate learning style.
I can't do a kinesthetic activity every class,
right? And again, and then the kids believe it because they're in that system that's pushing that same stuff. But it says here that the only factor they found that was a predictor of learning style beliefs for educators was the age of the population with whom they work. So I imagine it's probably a college elementary school difference. There's probably a high school elementary school difference. But it makes me think too that part of this is confounded in just the fact that, like, if you're dealing with an older population, you're probably not your standard elementary school teacher. The person who's teaching older people has gone through a slightly different path than the person who's helping six-year-olds.
Yeah, I think they're, it's sad.
Yeah.
Very bleak.
So grief.
So let's grieve about it. So this is not as pernicious, but
yeah,
it is a problem.
Sounds like it's kind of getting there, or maybe it's confounded. It sounds bad because it's kind of compounded with, like, you know, you've lost someone.
Right. This is kind of a pseudoscience that, like, hits you while you're down, and that's makes it gross.
Yeah.
And then there's some gross application to it, but I want to, like, clarify up front that I do not put any of this on Kubler-Ross herself.
Okay.
Like, in terms of, like, conceptualizing this as a stage theory, that she probably shouldn't have done that. But also, this was, like, the 20th century and stage theories were all the rage. So, like, I understand. Absolutely wonderful woman. Like, could not say anything bad about her. She was a, like, she was one of those people. I think I was reading up on her biography. She, like, ran away from home because her dad wanted her to be a secretary, but she wanted to be a physician. And so, like, she had to get out of her family and, like, pay for her education and do it solo. But she did, she worked at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, and she would bring in these medical students to interview terminally ill patients of, like, all ages, as a way to, like, this is not just a patient, this is a human, and your job is to treat the human. They're not, like, a subject. And so her stages of grief came out of, like, I think it was 150 interviews with terminally ill patients who were, like, in the process of dying. And so it started off as the stages of dying, and then she, like, applied it to stages of grief, and then, like, her foundation, like, turned around and applied it to a bunch of other stuff that's, like, crazy, like, for corporations. So there are stages of dying and grief trainings for when corporate decides to, what is it, reorganize people out of their jobs.
Oh, no. Because the way you're describing this, I felt, like, pretty good about it. I was like, you know, I can see that you're doing a bunch of interviews. You're able to kind of cluster similar results or similar comments into these, like, clusters. And then so you can kind of put them in, like, the level of, like, maybe worse off to best off.
And that's kind of where this came out of. But it's kind of, like, she wasn't systematic.
Okay.
So, like, I would not call her a scientist in the way that one would develop a stage theory.
Right.
It's kind of like a Myers-Briggs typography kind of situation going on.
Yeah.
It was very well intentioned.
Yeah.
Because she used it to, like, help humanize the dying and grief process for medical students and other people going through this, and it was, like, out of a genuine desire to, like, humanize death and grief. Lots of really good AIDS work, like, lots of good hospice work, like, the woman's gold. But her main idea of the grief cycle or stages of grief and dying is not good.
I mean, at least we could say in her case, like, unlike a lot of the people we're going to talk about this season, or that we have talked about, isn't just in it to make a buck.
It was a well-intentioned disaster. So I'm sure listeners are familiar with the grief cycle. It's called a cycle now for the same reason that, like, people apparently move in and out of learning styles. Because, like, the stage theory didn't hold up. Like,
right.
You can't, like, the fact that you made universal stages was the problem. So it starts with denial, avoidance, confusion, shock, fear, stuff like that. You go into anger, frustration, then you go into bargaining, and then depression, and then later acceptance. And it spits you out. And then when people realize that, oh, hey, like, I didn't go through those stages because I'm a unique individual. It got shifted to a cycle, and now it's taught in terms of like, oh, well, you don't have to start at denial. You could start with anger, and maybe you revisit some stages, and maybe you spiral through depression and acceptance, and maybe you do it backwards, and all sorts of nonsense.
Sure.
And so that's the issue there. And it was more of an issue or like in the late 20th century when people took it like terribly seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of mimetic now.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, I don't know of a therapist. Like, I'm not familiar with anyone who does any sort of like active psychological therapy that like takes this terribly seriously.
I would probably say the last time I've heard about it was probably in meme form.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But there was a small issue early on in its application when therapists were like, this is fabulous, I were going to use this. And then they found out that their patients weren't like fitting nicely into this like stage theory. And so there was some conflict, and like people kind of internalize this as like gospel truth. And so then they feel worse during their grief because they're not grieving right, whatever that means.
Oh, yeah.
So like it's hard on people. It hits the people who believe it the worst. But I think it's not nearly as bad as learning styles. Yeah. And I don't think it's as far reaching, because I did find like there is a corporate application. It's called the Change Curve. And it's pretty much the same. It goes shock, denial, frustration, depression, experiment, decision, integration. And so basically this change curve is used by individuals and organizations to understand their reactions to significant changes or loss, which makes me think if somebody shows up at your place of business giving you a change curve, like professional development, like you're about to get restructured out of the institution.
That is good to know. And also I would probably feel shock.
I mean,
what is happening?
What is happening? This can't be happening to me.
Right.
I put in 8 years at this institution.
Yeah.
Oh, look, we got the first three stages right there in one.
That's why we've got a union.
Right?
We go right to bargaining.
Right to there may be shock, but there is no denial.
Yeah, we go straight to bargaining.
So, having said that, not as pernicious, but I think it kind of tacks on, like, if you, this is like, maybe like my rule of thumb for like reading psych stuff and like parsing out pop psych,
yeah,
and older psych from like new research, is that if it's using a stage, if it's stages of X, Y, and Z, stages of this, stages of that, or if it's giving you different types of people or different categories that people fit into, it's probably bunk.
Yeah, I mean, and even like the best stuff is adapting away from stages.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would even argue like Piaget's stages of cognitive development. I mean, if we've learned anything from those in the last 30 years, it's been the ages are a lot more fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know that like about half of all people never fully enter the formal operational stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has a lot to do with education. And so if you've got more education, you're a little more likely to be in formal operation. If you've got a little less, you're a little more in concrete, and both of those you can flourish in or flourish with. There's not really like a one is, it's not like a hierarchy, like one isn't better than the other.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's probably why a lot of that, I don't know how much developmental psychologists are still like gung-ho, but I remember once asking someone like I want to like maybe put this in a survey, like, how do we test this? And they were like, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, Okay. And I've looked for like a formal operations, because I was really fascinated by this idea of like, not everyone fully enters a formal operational stage. Can we actually codify something like that? And like,
Right. Yep.
really, we probably, but you have to do it, and you probably have to fight an uphill battle against big developmental psychology.
Yeah. No. It's a little like we're moving out of it. I will say my favorite, like teach a death and dying class, or I did teach a death and dying class. And so typically, like, we have this conversation about the stages of grief. My preferred one that I think works really well is the Strobe and Schutt, which is 1999, called the dual process model of grief, where there are two modes that are happening at the same time. It's the confrontation mode and the restoration mode. And so through the grieving process, as someone goes through grief and bereavement, the confrontation is the emotional feelings, confronting the loss, actively grieving, like feeling alone, missing the person, that there's this like explosion of emotional energy that occurs. And then at the same time, restoration is working, which is the like re-knitting social groups without that person, focusing on the future, moving forward, trying to find new meaning, picking up the pieces around you and figuring out what your life looks like now. And like sometimes you're like more in one stream than the other, but both of them are operating through that grieving process, which is why it's not just hard because it's emotional, it's hard because it's also existential.
Sounds like it involves a lot of person plus environment.
Which I like this model better, because it doesn't tether anyone to stages. It doesn't like dictate the right way to grieve. It doesn't make any excuses for itself when it doesn't hold up. Like within the model itself, it understands that like you may not be ready to like engage in restoration for like 6 months. So I prefer that.
It's more realistic.
And even for people who like grieve but don't like wallow, you know what I mean? Like they acknowledge the loss and they feel bad, but they're like very much like, I gotta like clean up stuff and like tie loose ends and be very active. Like all restoration. Little bit of confrontation.
Yeah, I don't want to get too personal on this podcast, but I get it. I get it very much. I understand.
So, there are better ways to approach learning and grieving than these stages and these typologies of nonsense.
Typologies of nonsense. That's our title. I don't know. I like pseudo-psychological typologies. That's a mouthful, though. Hypological nonsense. Just
Typological nonsense. So
yeah.
that's what I got. Not as pernicious as learning styles. It did go through a rough bump, and I don't think Kubler-Ross was full of shit like I do the learning styles people.
And I mean, I would say the grain of truth in any typology or any stage theory is that it does allow us to kind of understand the clusters that we witness better. It's kind of more of an organizational or like an ordinal kind of ranking system. But even then, like, it really depends. Like, I would argue, like, Erikson's stages are very like ranked, but like his ages are really, they fluctuate. It's like, what happens if you're 30 and you're going through generativity versus stagnation? Like, I came to turn, I was like, well, I'm in a job, like I'm finishing grad school, like, or like what I was coping with at the time. I remember like thinking about going back to get my PhD. I was really coping about like, well, what am I gonna do? Like, am I just gonna like teach and be an adjunct for the rest of my life? And I was like, well, you know, like I think I'm pretty stable in my identity. I have people that I care about and who care about me. And I was like, I'm in my late 20s. I'm not supposed to be at this stage yet. Because there's only one stage after that, and it's ego integrity versus despair. It's death. Or acceptance or concern about death. And so I'm like, yeah, like, can I just like sit in generativity for like 30 years, 40 years? Sure.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, because you can, because it's not fixed. It's fluid. That I you know, I like Eric. I like the concept of like we have these conflicts and that the way we engage. I mean, he's a neo-Freudian, like like how we engage and how our parents help us. I like how the first five stages have nothing to do with our own personal choices.
Right.
It's all parental influence and environment on whether or not we get through, like, you know, those early stages. And but you could get through those early stages pretty quick, or they could take time, and that's going to vary person to person. We can't just anyway.
Got us hot and bothered.
Yep. We're in anger.
We're in anger. So, shall we transition?
Yes. Let us finish with our Ask Psychology question of the week.
Yes, I have one for you. So this was asked to me by a student recently, and I had to do some research to figure this out. So I'm going to ask you,
because
I use my like cognitive psych like education background and came up with like one of the possible answers to this question. So, what is déjà vu?
Ooh.
I'll give you a hint. There are four possible hypotheses that are being actively tested in this area right now.
I might be the weirdest person to ask about this, Thomas, because I've got some real weird experiences with déjà vu.
Would you like some fun facts?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to hear what some of the hypotheses say, because I've not only experienced déjà vu, but I've had dreams about very specific situations and places that I'd never been to, with people that I had never met.
That then occur.
Yeah, like weird things. Like not tied to déjà vu, but like I've had like my little brother and my dad have had the same dream one night. Like weird things. And again, like there's probably something in the environment that helps to shape that. Or there's probably like a series of, like, I would argue there's probably a series of coincidence that comes with like my brain just kind of jumbling stuff up and making interpretations and combining little bits and pieces that may have a chance of happening. And how many times that happens versus actual life experience, and then it happens 6 months later. But sometimes it happens when it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's real weird.
Hmm.
So I don't know.
Some fun facts about déjà vu. So 66% of people get it. So there's 34% of people who don't get it ever, which is weird.
Okay.
It decreases with age.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
It's associated with fatigue.
Okay.
It may be associated with dreams. We don't know.
Yeah.
And there is a continuum of déjà vu from brief and fleeting to chronic and prolonged. And the people on the chronic and prolonged are people with schizophrenia.
Okay. So mine has never been chronic or prolonged.
I'm not entirely sure what prolonged déjà vu is like.
Like days are happening. And you're like, I predicted this. I mean, it would make sense with like, because like one of the kind of hypotheses around schizophrenia is like we're adding a lot of additional meaning to things that are not meaningful. Mm-hmm. It's like the part of the reward circuit in the brain is like overloaded. Mm-hmm. And so we're attributing far more meaning to innocuous things. My experience with it has always been through dreams and mm-hmm. like again, like weird stuff, like at a state fair, with a friend of my dad and my dad, and then like my friend of my dad like tossing a rock at me to mess with me, like when I was younger. And like, again, super specific stuff. I dreamt about it 6 months prior. Or like, that was a weird dream. And then like, I'll be in the situation, be like, wait a second. And I don't normally remember my dreams either. Like, usually I'm foggy, but like there are some that are just stand out. They're weird. And I'll have moments where it's just like, wait a second. This is Ty. But again, like, those dreams are also like grounded in reality. And so I think there's still a possible, like, that's what explains it to me. Like, that there is just, my brain is making sense of normal day-to-day stuff that may eventually happen. Like, if I have a dream about, like, work. I haven't had a dream about work since I worked retail. Which is probably a good thing.
It is associated with fatigue. So, like, there is no fatigue like retail fatigue.
Well, I don't know. Well, yeah, it's very different. Like, I do feel fatigue after, like, teaching 3 classes in a day. But it is not the same as just being so physically worn down.
So here are our 4 hypotheses.
Okay.
For what might cause, and I order these in most likely to least likely, as I am, of course, a renowned cognitive psychologist who can assess these.
Yeah.
The first one is, there is an error with familiarity and retrieval. And so if you have retrieval without familiarity, then it's a jamais vu.
Yep.
And then familiarity without retrieval is deja vu. So whatever you're experiencing, retrieval did not occur, but it feels like it did. And so you get the sense of, like, I've been here before.
That to me, like, from where my what experience I have in cognitive psych, that makes the most sense to me. And that's probably arguably what's happening in my case, that I may be attributing it to a dream, especially that like was kind of maybe fuzzy to start with. And it feels like, wait a second, this has happened before. Happens when I get migraines too, and those are tied to swelling of the blood vessels in my brain. So
probably
also causing that too.
So the second hypothesis, which is also fairly plausible, is the encoding and retrieval hypothesis. So in normal cognitive processing, encoding and retrieval happen at separate times.
Yeah.
But in deja vu, they run at the same time.
Oh, interesting.
And so you're bringing memories up while you're creating memories at the same time. And so what you're experiencing that's currently being encoded is getting mixed with the memory that's being brought up through retrieval, giving you the familiarity.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
So that could explain your dream. If you dreamt that dream and then it happened in real life, then you would remember that dream and you'd be encoding that experience at the same time. So it leaves room for synchronicity there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have that weird kind of like, well, my brain's not working like it's supposed to feeling. And so it's distinct. It doesn't happen quite often. Yeah. Okay.
So the third one gets a little fuzzy. I'm not quite sure I understand this one. So this is the perception and memory hypothesis, which is memory follows perception like a shadow. Memory follows perception like a shadow. If this gets disruptive and storage occurs at the moment of perception, then it can cause deja vu. So your encoding and perception get rammed together instead of your encoding and your retrieval.
Yeah,
I'm having a hard time like understanding that one, so I put it lower, but it watch the cognitive psychologist who listen will be like, actually that one makes perfect sense and your other two are full of shit.
Sure. Yeah.
And then there's the dual consciousness model of deja vu, where we have an external and internal consciousness.
Ooh.
Which basically, it's not terribly fancy like a Freudian consciousness. It's the external consciousness is your awareness of your outside of your body.
Okay.
And what's going on around you and bringing in information. And then
much less exciting than I started thinking it was. Oh no.
sense of the internal self and your memories and identity and stuff like that. And this ties to the what is it, feeling exhausted, or like what was the word,
fatigued,
thank you.
Yeah.
In that your external consciousness, you don't have the energy to maintain the external consciousness, and so it like shuts down, and the internal consciousness is now in charge of like dealing with external information.
Oh, interesting.
But it only knows like memories and familiarity, yeah. And so whatever comes in is assumed to already be there.
Hmm.
Which is cool, but I'm not like, that's one definition of consciousness amongst 100, so
I'm going to posit hypothesis 5 that I'm a psychic.
Ah, there we go. So familiarity retrieval is my favorite one because it accounts for jamais vu as well.
Yeah. As yeah. No, I mean, that to me, I think makes the most, like, with my tapping into my own psych knowledge, makes the most sense. I don't think if you were to ask me that question, I could codify that in my head on the spot for an answer. Like, I'd have to do some research on it.
That was the answer I gave the student. Like, yeah. not in eloquent terms as familiarity and retrieval, but I right. was like, you're probably like misplacing familiarity on something.
Some wires crossed.
Yeah.
I like the idea too. I think that the second hypothesis probably does have some merit too, of like this stuff's happening at the same time when, mm-hmm. you know, 99.9% of our days it happens separately, but this one time everything fires at once. And it stuff like that happens. Like, we have these sort of weird quirks and the way our brain works, it's complex. It's not a 10% organ, it's 100%. You know, that there's all this stuff going on, and so a misfiring or some weird quirk may also explain why, like, there might be something. Do we have to go, like, talk to the neuroscientists and try to find some essential point of the brain that's tied to deja vu? What is the difference between the 66 or the 60 versus, you know, the 60-30 split, like, between those who experience it and those who don't?
Mm-hmm. And why do schizophrenics have prolonged and chronic deja vu?
Yeah.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, but maybe it's also tied to something like that, of like this firing of certain systems in our brain that are tied to things like reward or importance. Mm-hmm. Like, because I mean, that's part of what that reward circuit is. It lets us know, hey, that thing, that thing's important to us. That thing has meaning or is important in some way. And if that just fires, then we might be like, wait, why? And it mm-hmm. might also be why it becomes less with age. We do know that, like, past, you know, your mid-20s, your chances of being diagnosed with schizophrenia have become like next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you get older, you're less likely to experience stuff like this, because it's whatever part of your brain is developing that may help cause it, or is underdeveloped if you're younger, might be causing that to fire.
Hmm.
I don't know.
I don't either, but I will say that I have successfully horrified my COG class with the window of opportunity for schizophrenia diagnoses.
Yeah, so that comes up every now and then in a class. I think it came up in my social psych class, like that age range.
Yeah, no, they're all horrified. And one student in particular that we both really enjoy is ready to get out of her 20s.
The scariest way to put that is, so I had an abnormal psych teacher, a professor who was talking about schizophrenia and the age range, but didn't say it. Was just like, yeah, like, you know, within a certain age range, you're more likely to be diagnosed with it. Like, but once you hit a certain point, she's like, I'm well in the safe zone. And I was like, what's the safe zone? How old are we talking about here? And so, like, I had to go and look everything up and, like, feel terrified. I mean, I was in school a little late, but like when I was working my master's degree, I was within that age range. So yep. I was like, oh no, please. Let me just get through it.
Let me get through.
Man.
Oh, well.
So
what an adventure.
Yeah. So from learning the complete nonsense that is learning styles to the with good intentions
nonsense that is grieving.
That is grieving to the we're not really sure if it's nonsense. Deja vu. Let's move into more nonsense in the future, and we'll say until next time, more nonsense, more pseudoscience.
Huzzah, more pseudoscience next week.
Yeah. So goodbye.
Goodbye.